about this campaign in which we're now on the 255th day. We started on the 27th of June of last year, and we're going to go until July 15th of this year. And we're taking our inspiration from the 381-day Montgomery bus boycott. But Congressman Payne said to me that he was planning to come and join us on that picket line. And I'm just sorry. The whole community is going to miss him, and I'm sorry he won't be able to join us in person, but he will certainly be with us in spirit.
Where is the picket line?
We protest 5 days a week. We're at the intersection of West Market Street and Springfield Avenue, right across the street from Essex County College. We're there from 4:30 to 6 o'clock p.m.
And why did you choose that area?
Well, that's a high visibility, high traffic area, and we're trying to impact the general population. And it's in the center of downtown Newark. So we're there Monday through Friday. On Saturday, we move down to Broad and Market, which is just a few blocks away. And on Sunday, we return to West Market.
And the significance of doing this in Newark, Larry Hamm?
Well, the significance is that Newark, New Jersey has one of the highest rates of unemployment in the state. Right now, the official unemployment rate is about 15.6%. But if we were to count those people who stopped looking for jobs, whose unemployment has run out, it's more like 25 to 30%, which is almost three times depression level unemployment.
One of the earliest endorsers of Romney is your governor, Chris Christie. Your assessment of his running of the state?
Well, right now, I think a lot of people are really upset with many of the proposals that have come out. And I think this is going to be reflected in the vote in November.
And your assessment of President Obama? Don Payne, the only African-American Congress member in New Jersey's history. I think that says something about Don Payne and
right.
Also says something about New Jersey.
Yes.
President Obama, the first African-American president.
Well, I'm certain that President Obama is going to get the same massive voter turnout that he got in 2008. It may even be higher because of the opposition. It's just, these are people who are looking backward. They want to go past the Civil Rights Act. They want to go past the New Deal. And to go backward means more suffering and more pain in our community. And people are not just going to take it lying down. People are going to fight back. They're going to organize and they're going to mobilize. There's going to be a big turnout on Election Day. And I think after Election Day, people are going to stay in the streets to continue to pressure for jobs and for peace. One of the memories I have of Congressman Payne was when the People's Organization for Progress, together with other groups, pulled together the Peace and Justice Coalition in 2007. We had the largest anti-war march in the history of Newark, New Jersey. And Congressman Payne and Congressman Conyers were with us in the lead of that march on that day.
Well, I want to thank you, Larry Hamm, for joining us, New Jersey Chair of the People's Organization for Progress, and former New Jersey Assembly member William Payne, remembering his brother. Donald Payne died this week at the age of 77. He died of colon cancer, a sitting New Jersey Congress member. This is Democracy Now! Back in 15 seconds to talk about the arrests of a number of hacktivists, of hackers affiliated with LulzSec and Anonymous. Stay with us. Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we turn to the government crackdown on a loose, large network of politically inspired hacktivists, on Tuesday, four men in Britain and Ireland were charged with computer crimes. A fifth man was arrested Monday in Chicago. They were part of a group called LulzSec, affiliated with Anonymous, which has taken credit for a number of cyber raids against entities such as Rupert Murdoch's News Corporation, the intelligence consultancy Stratfor, and the Irish political party Fine Gael. The group has also waged cyber attacks against Fox News, the PBS website, Sony Pictures, and the U.S. Senate. Additionally, Lil Sack was involved in shutting credit card company websites after they refused to accept donations to WikiLeaks. Well, in a shocking revelation, the hacktivist may have been turned in by none other than the group's own leader, Lil Sack's chief hacker, 28-year-old, now identified as Hector Xavier Monsegur, better known by his alias Sabu. Apparently, Monsegur was caught last summer and, according to the FBI, has been working as an informant ever since. He allegedly directed fellow hackers from his public housing project in New York while turning around and feeding the feds enough incriminating evidence to build a case against his cyber comrades. Just last week, Interpol announced the arrest of 25 people suspected of being anonymous members in Europe. Monsegur reacted to that news on Twitter by urging sympathizers to attack Interpol's website. According to The Guardian in Britain, Monsegur may also have provided an FBI-owned computer to facilitate the release of 5 million emails taken from the private intelligence firm Stratfor and which are now being published by WikiLeaks. This suggests the FBI has insight into the internal discussions between Julian Assange of WikiLeaks and the hacking group Anonymous. Although no motives have been confirmed, some believe this is part of a larger strategy to build a case against Julian Assange. An internal email from Stratfor recently revealed that the Justice Department has already obtained a sealed indictment against Assange. For more, we're joined by two guests. We'll start with our guest in Boston, Massachusetts, Greg Hausch. He's a former Anonymous activist who remains in touch with members. Welcome, Greg. Talk about this latest revelation. Who is Sabu? What's your relationship with him? And what does this all mean?
Well, Sabu was with Anonymous before he was with Lulzsec. They sort of split off after the HB Gary hack. And I guess you could call him sort of a de facto leader of Lulz Security. The real first thing that came out of yesterday on, you know, all the IRC chats and everything else was, well, the news is coming from Fox News and supposedly the FBI, it's probably not credible. But when a lot of other news sources started reporting and everyone started believing, and then it kind of went into hectic repair mode. Who knows him, who talked to him, all that fun stuff.
Were you surprised? Were you shocked? And what does this mean for your organizing?
I was surprised, definitely. I mean, the most surprising thing to me, though, was, you know, something that you just mentioned, the fact that the FBI basically allowed a Lulzsec Anonymous to hack Stratfor and to dump all that data to WikiLeaks. They pretty much sacrificed Stratfor in the name of hunting down Julian Assange. And that's the strangest thing of all of this to me so far.
And the relationship between Lulzsec and Anonymous? Let me go to our second guest, to Gabriella Coleman, a professor at McGill University. We just lost Greg in Boston at the studio. Gabriella Coleman is a leading authority on the anthropology of digital media, hackers, and the law. Her forthcoming book is called Coding Freedom, The Aesthetics and Ethics of Hacking. Can you talk about these organizations, Lulzsec, as well as Anonymous, and their relationship?
Sure. So it's very interesting because Anonymous isn't located in one place, nor is it just one group of people.
Welcome to the Extra Environmentalist.
Your opposable thumb
means nothing.
This is what we want to be. We don't want to be Americans or Germans or English. We want to be extra environmentalists. Always feel wherever you go that you are a stranger, the outsider, the one looking in. This is the viewpoint that makes all places the same to you.
Hello and welcome to The Extra Environmentalist. I'm your host, Seth Moser-Katz, along with my co-host, Justin Ritchie. And we bring you another episode of The Extra Environmentalist. Today, we're talking with Ian McKenzie and Charles Eisenstein about Ian's brand new movie.
This episode, we're going to be speaking with Vancouver-based filmmaker Ian McKenzie about the film he made on Charles Eisenstein's book, Sacred Economics. And he did an amazing job of taking Charles's comprehensive book about economics and distilling it down into something that is only 12 minutes long. So that way, if you've read the book, you can send it to your family members and say, hey, mom and dad, I'm not crazy about this whole economic transition thing. There's a film out here that you need to see, and it's only just a little over 10 minutes. Check it out. And when the film was launched last week, Ian gave us the opportunity to host a live stream event on our live stream page at www.extraenvironmentalist.com/livestream. And people tuned in from around the world, sent us questions, asked questions of Ian and Charles. And so we're going to be playing that question and answer session for you today. But also, at the end of that conversation, we're going to be playing an interview with Matt Berkowitz, who is organizing Zeitgeist Day here in Vancouver this weekend, March the 10th here in Vancouver. And so you can check out the end of this episode to hear an interview with him to find out more about the event and how you can be there for speeches by people from around the world, engineers, economic thinkers trying to redesign our economic system, and Peter Joseph himself, the creator of the Zeitgeist films.
Yeah, so on that note, let's jump right into the episode. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM. And today, on The Extra Environmentalist, today we're talking with Charles Eisenstein and Ian McKenzie about the new film, Sacred Economics.
And we're welcoming everybody who is coming in from different sites on the internet who just watched the premiere of Sacred Economics, the film. This is Extra Environmentalist co-host Justin Ritchie. And today we have with us Extra Environmentalist co-host Seth Moser-Katz.
Hey there.
And also on the line, we have Charles Eisenstein and Ian McKenzie. And you saw Charles in the Sacred Economics film, and Ian was a filmmaker. So welcome, guys.
Thanks for having us.
So let's start out, Ian, if you could tell us when it was first clear to you that you wanted to create this film and what kind of target audience you were aiming for in making it.
Sure. Well, I've been a fan actually since reading Charles's Ascent of Humanity. It was actually posted by a friend of mine who just linked a bit to one of the pieces that was online. And then after I read it, it was directly related to something that I had been thinking that day, which was the idea that you can't solve our current economic, social, environmental problems just by slowing it down. In this case, it was by using, you know, reusable bags, like the same sort of mentality on a macro scale is kind of what we've been doing. And so when I read The Ascent of Humanity, a lot of what I've been pondering sort of fell into place. And then later on, I was really excited to hear that Charles was doing a book called Sacred Economics, specifically on the economic elements. And so after I read that book, I just decided that, I mean, the best way that I could sort of gift back, because Charles speaks, you know, very well about the gift economy, and this, the best way that I could gift back is by using my current artistic medium, which is film, and using film to then take the ideas of the book and help spread them. So the audience, I mean, you could say is people that also are kind of on that cusp and realize that, you know, again, the current way of dealing with the problem isn't really working. We need sort of a fundamental reimagining. And so the idea is to allow people to understand that there are people who have pondered this greatly and who are articulating some of this new imagination.
Yeah, exactly. Next message question goes to Charles. Charles, how you've been writing for a while now. How have you changed your message? How have you adapted it over time?
How have I adapted it over time? I guess earlier on, I was writing more for myself, actually. And especially because when I wrote The Ascent of Humanity, I was completely unknown and I didn't have a sense of an audience. It wasn't as much a conversation with anything that I could actually feel. Now when I write, I have a much better sense of, because I've been speaking so much and connecting to audiences, and now I'm kind of writing for them. Lately I haven't even been doing much writing because I've been speaking so much, although I have a new project brewing.
Brewing is good.
Yeah.
And so, Charles, how do you see this film taking your message forward? Do you find that when you're speaking with audiences, you're having issues connecting with them, and perhaps this film could help take your message to a wider audience? Or how is your message being received?
Well, no, when I'm actually in person in front of a group, then usually there's a very strong connection. But there's only one of me, and there's lots of me, actually. Lots of other people who are articulating the evolving myth of our people. But there's only one of me speaking, you know, about this, and I can only go so many places before I get burned out. So I'm hoping that this film, you know, even though, like, when I looked at rough cuts of it, I'm like, oh, I was, you know, part of me was like, oh, but the line of argument has some gaps in it and stuff. But, you know, then I realized that you really can't make an airtight argument and anticipate all objections in 13 minutes. So this film is really more just to convey, I guess, and help. They can be the ally of that inner voice that says, if I serve humanity or serve my bioregion or serve my community or serve my family, and then I'll be okay. And it's not crazy to do that. Religion can be an ally of that desire. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Jumping into some of the other questions from the chat, there is some mention of the Zeitgeist films and a resource-based economy. And I was wondering if either of you had any thoughts about those films and thoughts of how a resource-based economy either echoes or contrasts with some of the ideas presented in Sacred Economics.
I mean, I can answer that. I think the Zeitgeist films offer a pretty good explanation of how the current money system works. I don't fully resonate with the films when it comes to solutions. I think that they invoke what I call technological utopianism a little bit, kind of that technology is going to kind of come and rescue us, which is a mind form quite similar to the second coming. You know, some external thing is going to come and save us from ourselves. And also, you know, as far as resource-based economy goes, yeah, I mean, there's also, I think that's part of the picture. And the Sacred Economics describes practically how it terms it in terms of shifting taxation and money creation onto use of the commons and use of resources and pollution, which is also a use of a resource, rather than onto income or something like that. So there are resonances, but I do think that we will need money for the same reason that a multicellular organism needs signaling molecules to direct the flow of resources. And maybe centuries and centuries from now, society will have changed so much that we won't have anything that we could call money. But I think that that's a long way away. And I don't think that money needs to be a bad thing when its nature changes. So, but anyway, that's too much to go into in this venue. But I'll throw that out there.
Yeah. We had some questions about your influences, Charles. Daniel Quinn. Did Daniel Quinn play a part in influencing you, or was Whitehead's Process of Philosophy involved in that as well? If you could talk on your full influence.
Joseph Chilton Pierce, when he wrote he read The Ascent of Humanity way back, and he just thought that it was very Whiteheadian. Daniel Quinn. The Ascent of Humanity is in part a response to Daniel Quinn, Derek Jensen, John Zerzan, some of these anti-civ, as they're called, anti-civilization radicals, that basically say, yeah, this was a terrible mistake. The fall was when we began to domesticate other species and began to see ourselves as the lords and masters of nature. Jensen and Zerzan especially go back even farther. You know, they say that even symbolic culture was a mistake, an arrogance that separated us from reality. Language, you know, categories, naming things separates. But, you know, then I realized that this was based, even symbolic culture was based on earlier developments like fire and tool making. And animals use tools. So, you know, how far back do we want to roll the clock? I began to understand that all of these developments, tools, agriculture, even industry, information technology, all of these that separate us more and more from reality, from each other, from nature, these are part of a process that couldn't be any other way, a process that is reaching its fulfillment in our time, its extreme, or you could even say a singularity that's giving birth to something new. So that's kind of like the mythological level of what I write about. And then money, you know, then I describe in the book how money is part of this process of ascent, of separation, how it's generating a crisis that cannot be solved. by slowing it down, as Ian said, or improving things. And that is birthing us into a new era.
And in speaking of that technology, we've seen massive global protest movement grow up around the last year that perhaps maybe some of this visualized was possible, but maybe not even at this scale. And it's incredible to see it happening. But I'm wondering, in speaking about technology, is this global protest movement rising up because of the internet, or is it something else? And I wanted to get Ian's insights on that first, and then we can jump to Charles.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, this, a few of the visuals actually from this short film, and Charles himself actually, he appears in a feature documentary that will be forthcoming called Occupy Love, which is being directed by Velcro Ripper, that I'm co-producing. And that film itself actually kind of goes into the connections between this much larger protest slash unfolding. And what really struck us was that, but even before the Occupy movement started, that there was this movement brewing all around the world. And, you know, it takes different forms, right, depending on where it emerges, right? So in the in Egypt, you know, it's the Arab Spring. But even in places like Bolivia and the Cochabamba Accord, all these other places, that it's all part of the same sort of unfolding. And I think that, yes, of course, the internet is playing a role in connecting all of these people. Like Paul Hawken says that, you know, we're sort of this immune response to a planet in crisis is happening all over the world. And yet, up until, I believe, probably last year, that almost all of the different little pawns of this movement didn't know about each other, right? They kind of had this sense of like, oh, it's just, you know, just us against everyone else. And yet, as this Occupy movement, certainly, and other movements have sort of, you know, raised their heads and emerged, now it's suddenly, hey, wow, I can see you finally. And of course, that gives sort of inspiration and catalyzes others to get involved as well. And so the internet, I feel, is certainly the sort of connector of these movements that are happening anyway. But then again, it also reflects the movement back on itself and catalyzes it further. So there is, I think, a really strong feedback loop going on with the relationship between the internet and the social movements.
Yeah, and Charles, Charles, if you could talk a little bit about technology and your view of how it's either uniting us in this protest movement, despite its separating features, perhaps.
Yeah, it's definitely uniting us. And, you know, sometimes, as the Taoists say, the extreme of yang gives birth to yin. So on the one hand, information technology is the extreme of separation, where, you know, you're sitting in front of your screen withdrawn completely from not only from nature, but even from materiality. You're in this virtual world. Yet at that extreme, we've, you know, through the internet, we're now reconnecting and organizing, self-organizing even, in ways that are, and it's happening so fast that any powers that want to control it, they just can't keep up with how fast things are happening. The law of unintended consequences, the law of exponential increase in complexity as you increase connectivity has basically taken over. And that's why I think that we can no longer understand the way the world works you know, by explaining it in terms of a power elite who's masterminding and controlling everything. But yeah, I don't really have too much to add to that.
Yeah, that's interesting. I know you have to go, Charles, but I always wanted to get to hear about what you have coming up and what you're excited about, what you're getting into, what new projects you have in the future that we can look forward to.
Oh boy. Well, I'm going to be mostly speaking this year and not writing as much. But at some point, I'm going to be getting into other territory. I've been thinking a lot about the social construction of reality, I guess you could say, and the placebo effect and shadow realities. And
Do you mean by social construction of reality mainly the narrative that we all live by?
Yeah, that's part of it. And I've, you know, that's certainly a theme that's come up in the Ascent of Humanity and Sacred Economics too. But it gets a little bit weirder than that. But I'm not actually now. I'm not going to go into it anymore right now because it's very new right now. Although that article I had on Reality Sandwich, Synchronicity Myth and the New World Order, it has some of the ideas in it.
Well, I'd love to just get one more comment then from Charles about you had that new piece that came out recently that the way up is down,
uh-huh.
Maybe you could just sort of briefly summarize the what you were saying in there and why that is emerging, because that to me was really hit definitely that sense of you go ahead.
Yeah, that was interesting. That article was in the Watkins Review, or I think it's called Watkins Mind Body Spirit or something, but I was basically questioning the whole concept of raising our vibrations and ascending in consciousness, and saying, you know, what's wrong with low vibrations? What's wrong with the earth? You know, what is a low vibration? What's a high vibration? And a lot of some of my readers were a bit tweaked by that article. And they were saying things like, well, you know, don't you believe in these higher states of consciousness and out of body experiences and Kundalini and Chi and all of these things? These are all higher vibrations. And aren't we moving toward that? Isn't that what human evolution is? Spiritual evolution, moving toward that. And I think that the short answer is no. That a human being, it's not that we're a vibration. That's a dangerous idea. If you're a vibration, that means that some people are higher and some people are lower. It's another way of ranking each other and ranking people, and it's elitist. It's fundamentally elitist. And I think a lot of people can detect that among kind of new age thinkers. So it's not that we're moving to higher vibrations. It's that each human being is a symphony of vibrations that includes high and low vibrations. And that have their own kind of harmony, although there might be discordant notes as well. And what's happening today is that this human symphony of vibrations is entering a new movement. So our vibrations are shifting. But I don't think that you can say, well, I'm more evolved if I'm, you know, sitting on my meditation cushion having out-of-body experiences than as compared to, you know, being in your garden planting herbs with your hands in the dirt or doing physical labor. I don't think that we can say that one is better than the other, but I think that we're actually evolving toward a more beautiful and harmonious balance of the various vibrations that compose a human being. That's kind of what that article was getting at. And I think it's important because part of the poison that's infiltrated our civilization is this anti-materialism. You know, that we think that it's kind of the spiritual analog to the ascent of humanity to be the lords and masters of nature. The spiritual analog of it is that we become non-material. We enter this realm of spirit or mind, and that's our destiny. And therefore, it's quite natural that we're treating the earth like it doesn't matter, like just a bunch of instrumental stuff. And that is an important healing, I think, to realign or to reunite spirit and matter. And that's actually what is at the heart of sacred economics, too. Like, we have to make the world sacred. We have to make money sacred. And it's not to say that that these, quote, spiritual experiences are unimportant. They can be very profound. They can be profoundly important. But it's to recognize that they have a place within the symphony of vibrations that constitutes a human being. So,
excellent.
Yeah, thanks for that question, Ian.
Yeah.
No, I love it.
Well, Charles, you have to get going, and we're going to keep going on with the conversation for just about 15 more minutes here so we can find out more about Occupy Love and some of the things that Ian is working on. But thanks for joining us today, Charles. Really appreciate your work in helping to build that harmonious vibration that you were just speaking of.
Yeah, thank you guys for hosting this. And of course, 10,000 thank yous to Ian for creating this amazing film. So yeah, we'll be in touch.
Awesome. All right. Take care.
Okay. Take care, guys.
Bye. All right. So Ian, in moving forward in the conversation, I wanted to get some a bigger picture from you about Occupy Love film that you're working on with Velcro Crow Ripper. Where are you guys at in that project? And if you could describe it in a bigger way than we've already discussed in this conversation.
Sure. Yeah, so Occupy Love actually originally started, I'll take it back to the beginning. Velcro Ripper is an amazing filmmaker from Canada, and he's done a trilogy, actually, of films. The first one was called Scared Sacred, which was about him visiting ground zeros of the world, where he went around to like Cambodia, to Hiroshima, and these places to see what he could learn from sort of these horrendous, you know, events in human life. And the thing is, he did find the silver lining in the mushroom cloud, is how it says. And the second film he did was called Fierce Light, When Spirit Meets Action. And that actually was directly looking at what the term came about called spiritual activist. And so what does it mean to fuse spirit and action? And so he would chat with Desmond Tutu and Daryl Hannah and all these really amazing people that were using their sort of soul force, whatever, however they described it, to engage with the world and make transformation. And so at the end of Fierce Light, it actually, there's this allusion that Velcro makes to this idea that sort of, you know, what if we had a mass movement of spiritual activists, right? And he calls it the sort of the sleeping volcano that is coming to awaken. And that, of course, leads in perfectly with this idea of, you know, Occupy Love, this sense of a mass awakening. And the film was originally called Evolve Love. This is prior to the Occupy movement. This is about two years actually prior, when Velcro actually started filming. And he went around to all these different places around the world to sort of chronicle this sort of awakening. And the thing is, we had a cut of the film in early 2011, and we, you know, much of the sort of philosophical arguments and things were there. But what happened was we didn't really have sort of the unfolding action as it happens to make, you know, a great film needs that. And so Velcro just happened to be in Brooklyn when the Occupy movement erupted in September 2011. And he went down there on day one and just started filming. And for us, actually, we felt, we're like, this could really be the sort of movement that we knew was going to happen, or certainly in North America, this is the type of film or the type of emergent event. And the other thing that Velcro noticed right away was that there was hearts everywhere, right? That these like hearts or people with signs saying, you know, occupy your heart, that revolution is, you know, evolution is revolution, and love is highlighted. And there was this sort of emergent thread of the movement that was, you know, it just started happening. And so Velcro realized that, you know, hey, this is different. This isn't just, you know, hold up some signs and go home. This was a sort of here to stay emergent property of this movement, and I think all mass movements that are coming. And so Occupy Love is really chronicling that whole picture. And Charles Eisenstein is being featured in the film, and that's where the connection happened, that Charles will be speaking directly on this sort of idea of the revolution of love, which was another film that maybe many of you have seen. And that's more of a teaser for Occupy Love, the film itself, whereas Sacred Economics is now a separate film directly about the ideas in Sacred Economics.
So you've been traveling around to all these different Occupy sites. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly. I just wanted to ask you
what you had learned. What was the big lessons? What are the takeaway messages you've gotten?
It's really interesting. I mean, there is this sense of, you know, you could walk into any occupation, any Occupy movement, you know, in North America or even abroad, and you just feel, you know, at home. Like, you feel that the people there are, they just sort of get it, right? And it's not necessarily that they all think they have the answers, but they get that we need to reimagine, you know, how our institutions work. We need to reimagine, you know, how our money system is, how the education system works. And they understand, though, that it's no longer necessarily about, you know, projecting on this imaginary enemy that is keeping humanity down, but also that everyone needs a place in this sort of new new world that we're building. And so there is a real sense of coming home, I felt, to all the occupations where, you know, you just suddenly, you strike up a conversation and then there's this openness to listen and get involved. And it was really nice. Like, it felt like a bit of a family.
Yeah, and so it looks like you have a lot of material for Occupy Love as you've been going around. And someone in the live stream chat wanted to know if you were going to take the short film that you made of Sacred Economics and include any part of that in Occupy Love.
Well, there's a couple clips of Sacred Economics from Velcro that he's been shooting, and that those will actually, they're from Occupy Love, the feature film. And The Revolution is Love, though, which was the other short film that I released prior to this with Charles, that particular film, most of that actually will be directly in Occupy Love. So in that sense, there is definitely crossover. But Occupy Love, again, it has, there's so much material that needs to be covered. And so those elements will be included. But Sacred Economics, yeah, will stand alone on its own as its own film as well.
Yeah. So I wanted to ask here, you've been reading Charles Eisenstein's books. You've put together this really slick and well-produced film demonstrating his ideas. How are you actually taking ideas of gift economics and reaching out to your community and applying them in your own life?
Yeah, thanks. It's interesting because it is very much, you know, it's not sort of a philosophical idea like the gift economy. Like, it is, in a sense, like anything can be intellectual or intellectualized, where you just sort of think, oh, yeah, that's a great idea, but you don't really do anything. But I actually tried deliberately to see what I could do to include the gift economy in my own life and the type of work that I do. And one specific example that stands out for me is last November, I was actually asked to shoot a video with Robert Redford, the well-known actor that I'm sure most people know. And
wow.
he needed to shoot an interview about coming out against the Keystone pipeline, right? That they were trying to push through. And so I filmed the interview with Robert Redford, an amazing guy, very warm, friendly. And, you know, I felt a sense of just, you know, I wanted to do a good job. And at the same time, it just felt right, actually, to me that after the film, when I invoiced for the work, I included the amount of, you know, hard costs I had, like, you know, gas to get out there, you know, equipment rental, this type of stuff. But I included a line, and this is actually what Charles directly talks about, called gift. That this is a way that you can do it, where you can say, if you're a type of person that, you know, you offer a service or some sort of skill, you can offer it and put it as a gift. And that's what I did. So on the invoice, it actually has, you know, those other costs, and then it has, you know, time, gift, and just zero for that item. And then I invoiced, and you know, I just sent it off. And the thing is, it went through a production company that he was working with. So, you know, in my mind, whether he saw it or not was kind of irrelevant, right? It was just sort of it's more done in the spirit. That's what a gift is, right? It's done in the spirit of giving rather than expecting something in return. And so what happened was, though, you know, a week or so later, a friend who works with them as well said, you know, he saw that, and he noticed that I had put it as a gift. And she said he was very touched by that, and that he asked me to come back for two more shoots after that. And I believe a large part of that was because offering it as a gift, you immediately create a relationship with somebody, right? Whereas, as we cover in the film, Sacred Economics, this idea of the transaction relationship, you know, you pay somebody, they give you the thing that you're buying, whatever it is, and then you part ways. And that's sort of an ideal relationship in our consumer society. But the problem with that is, again, you don't have a relationship. And so immediately by offering your services as a gift or even partially, all of a sudden you're creating real relationships with other people, and they want to support you back because that's how a relationship works.
Yeah. Charles is a really, really good storyteller, and in a lot of his work, he tells different kinds of stories. Do you see your film as a story, telling a story, and is your film trying to contribute in a new way to Charles's stories and build upon them? How do you see that the stories aspect of your film working in with Charles's message?
Yeah, I think, I guess I look at it as, you know, film is a certain way of telling a story. And that for me, I find that film can create a much more of an emotional response to the material at hand. And I think my aim really was to hit people on the emotional level, because too often, you know, we look at the logic of the mind that, you know, has a certain idea of that things are a certain way, and it's really hard to sort of break that certainty. And I think that emotionally, though, you can hit people with film to really get beneath that logical mind and sort of hit that the heart of knowing, right? That says, again, those whole ideas of life should be something that you love, that school should be something that you love, that why can't you live in a way that you're giving your gift, right? And so what I'm trying to do with the film aspect is awaken those. And Charles obviously does a great job of that as well. But I think film also, certainly in our sort of connected social environments now online, that film is much better suited to spreading in that it's called, you know, they call it the new sphere, NOO sphere, where you can sort of insert these sort of mind bombs or whatever you want to call them that can be added to the ecosystem and spread rapidly, right? So they do offer this sort of complementary aspect where the books can go more in depth, and they can also attract a logical mind. But I find film, to me, is the ultimate way to really, again, hit people on the emotional level and then get them to sort of put their imagination into practice, you know, to add, to really take a look at the what is the story that we're collectively telling ourselves, right? And can we tell a new story?
Right. The power of film to actually change consciousness is unbelievable. And so that's why it's really incredible that you're taking these ideas from Charles Eisenstein's quite large book. It's a very easy read, but it's still quite a large book, and then distilling it down into a 12-minute film. And so we're coming up on the end of our time here on this call. And so I just wanted to close out by asking you, Ian, if there's anything that you think all the people who are tuning in now in our live stream chat, and also who may tune in to the conversation that we post in later, should know about as they finish watching this film and as they get ready to see your next work, Occupy Love.
Yeah, awesome. Thank you. Yeah, so before we go, I just wanted to thank everyone involved in the film. Certainly Brian Duffy and Adam Gian Gregorio, who I actually met at the Evolver event in Boston, and they offered to use their animation skills, which they gifted, right? Speak about the gift economy. So those two guys did an amazing job of the animation, as you can see in the film. Also, other people to thank. I mean, Velcro, as well as Greg Hill, is the co-producer on the film. They gave, you know, excellent feedback. Certainly, Charles, and the music. Actually, if you're interested to learn more, Chris Zabriskie was the composer who offered all of his music online for free. He offers it as a gift to the commons, and you know, I was so happy when I found it, because to me that fit so perfectly with the mood and the emotion I was trying to create. And I mean, everybody else, the full credits are just below on the page, and amazing talents all there, and many of them were gifted. I want to say thanks for that. In terms of the film itself, I would love for everybody to just share it, right? It's online now, and would love if you could post it to your Facebook, you know, tweet it, write a blog post about it. And also thanks to everyone who
depends on how they ask, you know, their question, how they show their interest and what their background is really. If someone just comes up and says, tell me about this, I will first ask them if they've heard of the movies or the movement. If they don't know anything, I would just say basically that the Zeitgeist movement looks towards the root causes of our broadest social problems and attempts to find the lowest common denominator for these problems and attempts to correct them, or rather is proposing a solution that corrects these problems at the core level. Thus, we find the entire socioeconomic system unsustainable inherently, and that's why we are advocating a new social system, which could be termed a resource-based economy.
Excellent. So in wrapping up, do you want to plug the website again so people can come and find out more and maybe a phone number and email address?
Sure. The website for the local chapter is zeitgeistvancouver.com. If you want to get in touch with us, there's a contact button on the top of the webpage. Although the email address is contact@zeitgeistvancouver.com. So you can get in touch with us that way. And then there's the main website. The main international website is thezeitgeistmovement.com and then zdayglobal.org.
And just one last opportunity for you to plug the event, times, dates, location.
Yeah. The main event is at the Vogue on March 10th. That's a Saturday. And doors open at 11 a.m. and the day's events start at 12 p.m. and it goes till about 6 p.m. The following day, we'll be showing a screening of Zeitgeist Moving Forward, the third film, at Denman Cinema. That's Denman and Comox, and that'll be Sunday, March 11th, also starting at 12 o'clock, and there'll be a Q&A panel after that.
All right. Thanks so much.